is Bird Note. Barnacle geese are stunning birds. Their feathers are boldly patterned in black, white, and silver. In Europe, huge flocks gather in pastures and mudflats where the geese feast on grasses and moss, but not barnacles. So where did they get that name? The answer harkens back to a medieval myth. Barnacle geese have wintered in the British Isles for millennia. People from the Middle Ages observed that adult birds would turn up in autumn, then vanish come spring. Since locals never found them with goslings or eggs, they scoured land and sea for an explanation of how the geese reproduced. What they found were barnacles, ones that have a large white shell attached to a long gray stalk. To early naturalists, these barnacles looked suspiciously like a bird egg growing from a gooseneck. Putting two and two together, great minds deduced that the mysterious birds must hatch from barnacles. Modern science eventually debunked the myth that geese spontaneously generate from marine crustaceans. They migrate to the Arctic to breed, but the name stuck. So even today, barnacle geese tell a tale as old as medieval times. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for tonight, Hale, and with me is Brandon. Brandon, how are you this evening?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm looking forward to this pretty concise but still jam-packed reading. We're reading, I guess you can introduce what we'll be discussing today.
Yeah, I guess I'll do it because I was the one that actually found this reading. To get into it, I do want to say one thing, though, just as a side for listeners. I realize you and I are often quite casual, and, we said good evening. I realize that when you're listening to this, it might not be the evening. So also, good day or good afternoon or good morning if it's that time. But for us, it's good evening currently during this recording session. So with that, we're reading an interesting short paper, as you said, called Inverted Totalitarianism, actually a preface, by Sheldon S. Wolin. This is actually a preface to his much larger book. However, the preface was published as like a short article. So it kind of gives a general overview of his thoughts. Inverted Totalitarianism, which is, I think, the subtitle of the book, I believe it's the proper name is Democracy, Inc., Democracy Incorporated.
So the full title of the book is Democracy Incorporated, Managed Democracy and the Specter of Inverted Totalitarianism.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of those terms, like Managed Democracy, Inverted Totalitarianism. Personally, I think they're pretty much synonymous, at least from a short reading of each other. This is a book that I've been like loosely aware of as kind of a, you know, political alternative critique. I've often seen it in some of the same vein and same circles as, in the past. I'm sure we've read some stuff by Mark Fisher, like Capitalist Realism and stuff like that. And there's a little, I think ideologically they're quite different. There's some of the same sort of real pessimism and concern and an act of trying to be revealing of some really deep-seated stuff in our sort of philosophical, political, and cultural landscape that is very prescient, very modern. I mean, this is about 20 years old. However, it feels, as I'm sure we'll get into it, I know to me at least it reads as being quite current, maybe like concerningly so at this point. But just as a little bit of information on the author, Sheldon S. Wolin was a pretty well-respected political scientist and political theorist who spent most of his time as a professor at Princeton University. And this is one of his, he had another big kind of work. It's this one and another one that was earlier, and I forget the name offhand. And interestingly about him, he passed away in 2015. He was quite elderly at the time, but he served during the Second World War as a navigator on a bomber in the Pacific and flew over 50 missions. So he was kind of one of the greatest generation types, right, who then in the 50s, 60s, and 70s became quite a well-respected, kind of more left-leaning political scientist. Wollin wrote, "Certain tendencies in our society point in a direction away from self-government, the rule of law, egalitarianism, and thoughtful public discussion toward what I have called managed democracy." Wollin was obviously someone who felt very strongly and was very much a proponent of the traditional democratic egalitarianism, and he said rule of law, ideas of modern democratic systems. He certainly was not like a communist or strong, like super strong left wing or something like that, but someone who often, reading a little bit, reminds me in some ways of people like John Rawls and Ronald Dworkin and stuff like that, who believed that the right system was one that was coherent and dependable and open and was as democratic as realistically possible, as he often taught. I listened to some interviews with him as well, talking about the ideal of what the founders set out. And basically, as you and I have read in Inverted Totalitarianism, his argument is essentially that there is that capitalism, and particularly large corporate business interests, have basically turned the system upside down. And in many cases, without anyone really, most people not even noticing, is the kind of the important point.
If we're going to start talking about what managed democracy is, what inverted totalitarianism is, what does Wollin sort of think is the initial beginnings of this, or how does this start?
Well, I think there's actually, as you and I actually mentioned before we started, the paper jumps around to a lot of interesting concepts that kind of all are sort of loosely woven into this idea of managed democracy. One of the main things he points out, at least to sort of set the stage, is he's like, look, to actually read his own words, he says, very beginning of the paper, by the way, "As a preliminary, I want to emphasize certain aspects of the approach taken in this volume in order to avoid possible misunderstandings. Although the concept of totalitarianism is central to what follows, my thesis is not that the current American political system is an inspired replica of Nazi Germany or George Bush as Hitler." He's obviously in the Bush era. "References to Hitler's Germany are introduced to remind the reader of the benchmark of the system of power that was invasive abroad, justified preemptive war as a matter of official doctrine, repressed all opposition at home, a system that was cruel, racist in principle and practice, deeply ideological, and openly bent on world domination. Those tendencies, I believe, are totalizing in the sense that they are obsessed with control, expansion, superiority, and supremacy." So he then goes on to talk, basically, look, he pulls a lot from, he's particularly Nazi Germany, but also the Soviet Union, in terms of, like, classical totalitarianism that we talked about, like, many times on the show, and how inverted totalitarianism, it's still a totalitarianism type of political ideology because it's still totalizing in the sense that it's obsessed with control, expansion, superiority, and supremacy. It might not be as violent or overtly evasive or racist or xenophobic, but it's still obsessed basically with complete control. And it might not also be as direct. And then it kind of talks at length about what are some really significant differences, and probably the most significant difference, I would say, between classical, fascist-esque totalitarianism and what Wollin sees in inverted totalitarianism or in a managed democracy, is this relationship with the economy. In this is actually like a funny thing because of the arguments that people get in terms of like, there's this really common like frustration or argument with, you know, was people online, you'll see it, people will be like, is Nazi Germany, were they capitalist? Were they communist? You know, were they socialist, really? All this kind of, and, you know, and obviously it's like for one side to throw shade at the other because, you know, whichever side Hitler was on is obviously the wrong side, blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of sort of the argument. But Walden kind of points out the truth, which is that economics for a traditional fascist regime is a tool. And so whether it runs in a more classically capitalist vein or whether it runs in a more socialist vein with more state control, ultimately it doesn't really matter. They're going to do what they think is best, and they're going to use the economy as a tool.
Yeah, totalitarianism sort of just instrumentalizing every single institution toward its own ends in that way.
But in inverted totalitarianism, basically what you have, at least according to Walden, is where the economy, in a sense, comes first. Because really what's happening is corporate and business interests are effectively positioning themselves in an elite circle that can put pressure on and operate in, and often is kind of overlapping and, you know, very jointly connected with the state, right? There is this, you know, the separation between large corporate interests and the state begin to break down, and so you have an effect, in a way, the economy kind of driving how the state operates. Obviously, this is problematic if you're coming from the kind of classically liberal democratic view where, you know, the state, as we understand it, is really supposed to be a representative of the people that's, like, properly and fairly elected, and does, you know, their primary interest is to do right by their constituents, to do right by the citizenry, right? And if it doesn't, it's not hard to see how having corporate interests sort of invasive in that process would at the very least dampen the effectiveness of that kind of system and certainly taint its, like, you know, political, social, cultural sanctity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense that it would do that. Right. If, and I mean, it's interesting that the economy can be a totalizing force, right? And that in this inverted totalitarianism, the economy takes the place of any particular sort of ideological, totalizing or dominating ideological goals, right? So instead what we have is this drive for just total economic expansion. I mean, this is kind of a bit of the, I can like kind of see a bit of the Marxism in this, where it's like, you know, capitalism breeds, or capital breeds capital. It's an infinite process. It just works it for the behest of itself. That's kind of how, it can be a totalizing process. I mean, it's almost, I don't know if anything elevated to an end can be a totalizing process, but the analysis of capitalism is one way that you can see that the economy can take on that way. And I think that that's something else that Walden does talk about as well when he's talking about the way that capitalism as an economic model emerges through changing ideas of change and the emergence of this notion of progress, and progress becoming the prerogative, or progress being seen in the Enlightenment era as being what will be good for the citizens. And that's kind of the way that the that's kind of the shell game, as it were. Yeah, because governments are supposed to, again, be for the behest of their citizenry. But Enlightenment thinkers come along and realize that there is this system, capitalism, that if you allow it to abide by its own logic and not step in and try to play the game for it, they see that there is a self-regulating and self-moving system that can work for the people, because this is generating constant change. And progress is good for the people, But
yeah, and you know, and I think it's really important that you brought it, because obviously Willem brings up the concept of progress, right? And particularly within the relationship of the Enlightenment, and when we have this kind of like democratic earnestness, is particularly in the West, right? I think about like the American Revolution, you know, and then, you know, later on in most cases, the revolutions and formings of democracies in Europe and all this kind of stuff, right? And there was this notion, as you kind of point out, even before that a little bit with like the kind of aristocratic era, even where it's like, you know, progress of, you know, we kind of elevate, you know, in the Enlightenment era, we elevate man, right? Man becomes the sort of, for like the way I say, measurable things, much older quote than Enlightenment, but it becomes, you know, the human experience, the elevation of human beings, you know, becomes the kind of focus of a lot of cultural and by extension, like state interests. And you see a lot of kings and aristocrats and early presidents and all this kind of stuff making significant moves and gestures that are about, you know, this sort of improvement of mankind. I mean, the most obvious one from the American point of view would be, you know, the abolitionist movement and Lincoln, you know, and eventually Abraham Lincoln, which, you know, in the American Civil War and all this kind of stuff. But there was this real fervor of like, you know, we're doing the morally right thing. We're unbonding, you know, human beings from servitude. But also, too, like the slavers and slave culture is in themselves like regressive, right? By being allowed to do this. And like, it's an improvement overall for everybody to make these sorts of substantial changes. That's like an obvious example. The other obvious American examples would be, especially during the New Deal era, when you had a lot of like, this would be like the 1930s, 40s. And really right up into the 1960s with Lyndon B. Johnson and the war on poverty, you know, the war on poverty and such, where, you know, this idea that the state is going to be, at least in the American context, not the only participant, but deeply involved and focused on improving people's station, right? Improving the general human situation, improving the situation of your citizens, right? But there's, Walden points out that there's like a pretty significant change that happens, and in many ways it happens earlier, but I think that it's, I think realizes that it's really heated up over the past few decades, which is in a capitalist society, there's, as you kind of mentioned, there's this idea that we can hand that process over to private interests, right? Like we can hand that process over to corporations and they can do the research faster, they can do the production faster, they can do all this stuff more quickly. And obviously that's going to be better, right? And so that's where Walden actually talks quite expansively about this concept of change within culture, change within society, right? That and he particularly points out that, interestingly, that American society is all about change, right? Like people think about, a lot of times people will talk about American society being super conservative, but really it is, and this is, I think, a modern thing in general, but it's particularly true with the West, and particularly true in North America, I think, more than anywhere else. You know, for like eons and centuries millennia and centuries, you know, there is spots all over the world and communities and cultures that lived relatively similarly, there was a pretty consistent cultural, social, environmental, structural coherence between, you know, 300 years now and then, right? We see this sort of production, this sort of mass change, this mass growth or whatever. And I think Walden makes this really astute kind of observation, which, as you sort of said, is typically like a materialist and kind of a little bit of a Marxist observation, which isn't necessarily anything wrong with that at all, which is basically, look, if you're going to hand this process over to private enterprise, then they are going to try and maximize that process for financial gain, right? And if shifting is the name of the game to make money, then make that change happen super fast, right? More products, more media, more shifting, more wants, more needs all the time, get it on, like, go. And I think Walden recognizes, and I think most of us, at least I would hope most of us, can step back and experience, like, it kind of feels that way. Like, that's kind of the ether that you live in.
Yeah. I mean, even just culturally, right? And we can talk about the relationship between culture and politics in a second. But just even anecdotally, like, I have, you know, as students of philosophy, as philosophers even, you step back and you realize some of the strange things that we experience, almost like these metaphysical realizations. Like, isn't it interesting that, you know, every year a new car comes out? Couldn't we just, or like a new phone or something? And I'm not just saying like phone bad or anything like that, but just the realization of like, there's this constant, it's not just even like, you know, like, okay, say we make a shovel and we just keep making that one shovel. Okay, well, we got to make that shovel because people need shovels. But imagine if we made like a shovel and then shovel two and then shovel three, and then you're like a loser if you only have the shovel one. You know, we're a culture that constantly changes and cycles through these productions in this way, right? Whereas, I mean, I was thinking about that, and then I also realized that there is something about a car that needs to be updated for different roads, right? For different road regulations, you need different models. Safety standards change, right? So there is this, but still.
What is the significant difference between the one from the year before, the one the year after? And, you know, actually, I think cars were a good example, because it's like, yeah, like, cars are changing, but is you buy a, you know, a 2025 BMW model, it's not really going to be substantially different than a 2023 or 2024, right? Like, there just isn't, but, like, and you easily could continue producing that model with any shifts, but there's just always this need for things to be constantly new, right? And recycled and revamped and all this kind of stuff. I think that Wolden's, you know, as you ask, as, you know, as listener or whoever might think, okay, well, what's this have to do with inverted totalitarian? What's this have to do with managed democracy? If you hand that process over to corporate interests, you are basically handing over, you might call it the crow's nest, the navigation room of the culture, to that process as well.
It's one thing to say, like, we're all going to agree to update our phones every year or something like that, or get new cars or something. You know, you need to get new clothes because clothes wear out, fashions change, that's sure, that's fine. It's a whole other thing to make the step that Enlightenment thinkers would have made, which was to say, actually, we should run our states like this, right? To kind of weave the political institutions on this change, right? Because remember, they are moving, or at least in inverted totalitarianism, which, you know, the Enlightenment kind of creates the conditions for, but only really find themselves being realized now. You are handing the reins over to a dynamic, changing process, which is the economy, right? This is the other big thing that I wanted to touch on with change as well, was Wolin makes this really great point that to have a stable government, to have a stable democracy, you have to have a stable institution, right? So to introduce this process of dynamism, of constant change, is just to create the conditions for the instability of something that needs to be stable, right? We need, and, you know, evidence for this is something like, like in America, a constitution that they hold to very strongly and that they observe and are constantly reinterpreting, but that's what you have to do with a text. That's how you keep it alive, and that's how you keep it what it is. Right. But that's not necessarily to say that it's being changed all the time. It would be, you would be changing it, and you would be finding, you'd be introducing that economic dynamism and change as soon as the interests of the economy find themselves prioritized over the interests of ostensibly democratic society.
So discussing this concept of change, but particularly its relationship to our institutions and values and the structure of society, says the fundamental reason for this deep-seated carelessness is related to a well-known American zest for change And equally remarkable, the good fortune of Americans in having at the disposal a vast continent of rich natural resources and inviting exploitation. Although it is a cliche that the history of American society has been one of unceasing change, the consequences of today's increased tempos are less obvious. And I think, notice how he wrote increased tempos. It's that process, he, at least in his perspective, this process is speeding up considerably. Change works to displace, this is, I think, the core part, change works to displace existing beliefs, practices, and expectations. Although societies throughout history have experienced change, it is only over the past four centuries that promoting innovation became a major focus of public policy. Today, thanks to highly organized pursuits of technological innovation and the culture it encourages, change is more rapid, more encompassing, more welcome than ever before, which means that institutions, values, expectations share with technology a limited shelf life. We experience the triumph of contemporary and its accomplished forgetting, or a collective amnesia. Stated somewhat differently, in early modern times, change displaced traditions. Today, change succeeds change. And then this is next, actually the next paragraph, is I think the point of, okay, well, what does this have to do with totalitarianism? The effect of unending change is to undercut consolidation. So what do you mean by consolidation? As he points out in some other areas, there is no effective political opposition. Right. If and I wrote actually on my own paper, and I guess ironically reminded me, and I say ironically because the word is, I wrote confusion. I think one of the essential aspects of modern culture as it relates to inverted totalitarianism, if we kind of accept or vibe with the model, is confusion. Right. That there is this constant unending noise of basically media stuff. And this has been really, and also in kind of, as many people call, the empire of things, the classic consumerism, right? Not to sound really smug, but these, you live in this world where there's, the news that you're getting, we've talked about this in episodes on media and media theory in the past, with the introduction of something like the Telegraph, suddenly, information became, information was no longer bound by space, right? No longer bound by space and time. And now, never mind the Telegraph, we're, almost two centuries later and things are exploded endlessly. And it's, there's constantly a million things being discussed all the time about happening all over the world, and new shows and new YouTubers and new social media apps and new big hits and new, and all these things are coming and going and passing in and out of existence, and you've got to buy it when it's hot and when it's not, and why you have it, and all this kind of stuff, right? And that confusion doesn't allow for, as he says, for a kind of consolidation. It doesn't, the political world, the cultural world feels, where does one step, where does one find one's people, where does one find the ground from which to, kind of hold the line effectively, right? And so I think that these kind of idea of confusion, of chaos, of this constant uneasing, which was originally idealized as progress, but which I think is arguably morphed into something completely different, doesn't allow for space for coherent opposition, which almost immediately critically affects the liberal democratic model.
Yeah, absolutely.
If there's no room for opposition, if there's no, here's the most obvious example in the West, there's no coherent labor movement anymore. There used to be a time in Western democracies where there was a significant organized labor movement that had significant political representation at every level and had pull and had effort and had effect, right? If one reads particularly European, especially early 20th century, late 19th century, the idea of the general strike was a big thing. This is where all the workers, all the people would basically, sometimes throughout the whole country, would more or less stop working because of some political issue or movement or or legislation, right? Where could you imagine a general strike happening in the United States today or anywhere?
No.